Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted, and we'll hear our arguments next in Badarek against the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Fredericks, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. And please the court. This matter comes to the court from an appeal from the Third Circuit. The facts in the case are not in dispute. Basically, it is a simple legal issue that is presented here today. Simply put, the question is one of whether an individual who has initially filed a fraudulent tax return and subsequently comes forth and files an amended tax return, whether by that act he begins the running of the 3-year statute of limitations applicable under the Internal Revenue Code, or, as the government alleges, he is forever opened to an assessment of tax upon the filing of the initial fraudulent return.
Where would your argument take you if, when the amended return was offered, tendered, the commissioner refused to accept it?
I think, Your Honor, under that point, the government could argue that there was no amended return filed, and I think that we would be in a very difficult position to start the running of the amended return. The government could, I would think, say that the amended return is not filed. In this case, and the cases that have taken place in the Second, Fifth, and Tenth Circuit, that is not the facts that we have to deal with. In fact, in all of those cases, the amended return was taken, and the tax that was due on the amended return was collected by the Internal Revenue Service.
Do you think that barred them from taking any other position? Is that your point?
Well,
by taking the amended return?
I think that the issue of the amended return is one that the government presses, which I have always thought has been a question of an ostrich-type argument insofar as they can deny the existence of an amended return, except that the Internal Revenue Code at length refers to amended returns, and it is a practice that has been going on for some time and has been recognized by the courts and in many cases has been used by the government in connection with their criminal prosecutions of people who have been filing tax fraudulent tax returns in the first instance. The Dowell case and the Clem case, I believe, in both instances, the government used the amended return as part of their case in chief to establish the question of fraud. I think that the question that the Chief Judge poses is an interesting one. I really can't answer the question of what would happen if the government refused to accept that amended return, which they may or may not have a right to do. But in this case, and in the cases that have the issue has been presented, that has not been the situation. The amended return has been fully accepted by the government. And we suggest that upon the filing of that amended return, that the tax court ruling in Bennett, which was decided in 1958 and acquiesced in by the United States government, which was a case of the fraudulent failure to file a tax return at all, and a criminal prosecution of that taxpayer for fraudulently failing to file, and a subsequent filing of a non-fraudulent return, the tax court and the government concluded that at that point, the 3-year statute of limitations provided in 6501A began to run. I suggest that there is no basis to distinguish that case from the case at bar.
Well, Mr. Fredericks, the language of the two subsections is different.
I respect
in the case of the original non-filing of a return, the section says within 3 years after the return is filed. I mean, there's language.
No, I think the subsection language is not different, Your Honor. The subsection language, C3 and C1, are identical. They both provide that if you fail, that the statute shall not run.
Well, the language in 6501A does say that the tax will be assessed within 3 years after the return is filed. Does
That's
it
correct.
Not? And that language would then apply where there is originally no return filed, but later one is filed. Now, I don't see how, when you compare that with the language for the fraudulent return that is filed and subsequently an honest return filed, the language is so different that I don't see how you can make the argument you're making.
Well, I don't believe that the language in 6501C, 1 and 3, are identical. What you're referring to is the initial language in the first section as to the statute of limitations. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that one must go back to 1918 when the statute was first enacted. And at that time, Congress provided a 5-year statute of limitations and an exemption in the case of filing a fraudulent tax return. No mention was made at all on failure to file. In 1921, Congress then enacted what is now the predecessor of the sections we're dealing with. And it said, the fraudulent failure to file or, filing of a fraudulent return or the failure to file, in a single sentence. And I suggest that that indicated an intention by Congress to deal with these two situations identically. In fact, all of the circuit courts that have considered this matter have all concluded that the two sections must be read in pari materia. I don't think that's in question here. It is only in 1954, when the 54 code comes into being, that the two sections, which were in one sentence, were split into two sections. And there is no substantial legislative history one way or the other to indicate why. I suggest that the legislative history, which indicates that the both of these sections were to be treated identically when they were initially enacted, indicates there should be identical treatment. Therefore, when one fraudulently seeks to evade the tax law by failing to fraudulently file a tax return.
Failing to fraudulently file a tax return?
Well, that was the facts. That's where the facts were in Bennett. The taxpayer, with an intent to evade the tax, filed the return. I mean, there was the
between failing to fraudulently file and fraudulently failing to file? I mean, failing to fraudulently file to me.
I'm sorry. That you had planned to file
a fraudulent report, but you didn't.
I'm sorry. What the Bennett taxpayer did was, with the intent to evade the tax, with the full fraudulent intent, failed to file the return. What the taxpayers in this case did was filed a fraudulent return and subsequently filed an amended return. I suggest that
now, if a taxpayer simply negligently, not fraudulently, failed to include more than 25% of the income, then there's a 6-year statute of limitations,
which begins to run from the day that return is filed, irrespective of whatever transpires. That's correct.
Now, but under your theory, you'd be better off if you had a fraudulent intent than a negligent intent, because then it would just be a 3-year statute of limitations.
No, that's not true at all, because if you filed and it was fraudulent, you have three things that have to come into play. One, and that you would be subject to criminal prosecution. You would have 6 years in which the government could indict you and try you. Two, you would be subject to the 50% penalty. And three, in order to have a statute of limitations to begin at all, you would have to have filed an amended return. Yes, if the fraudulent return was filed on April 15th and the amended return was filed on April 16th. Now, in that case, there is no running of a statute from our position. The 16th, the 3 years would begin to run. That taxpayer might be in better position than than the fellow who negligently forgot his 25%. But that taxpayer came in immediately, rectified his situation, and gave the government the information at hand.
Well, that difference and the fact that the Congress treated the negligent omission differently does give some meaning to the language that I referred to earlier. I mean, the scheme holds together a little better, doesn't it, if that's the
case? I suggest not for this reason. Congress, there is some legislative history on the six-year, the reason for the six-year statute of limitations, and that was that that begins to run from the day it's filed, whether the government discovers it or not, so that the government, without having the benefit of the information, has got a six-year statute running on it. And therefore, the Congress said that we're going to give him an additional time to catch up this possible mistake if it was negligent. Obviously, if it's fraudulent, there's no statute of limitations of any kind.
Mr. Frederick, can I ask on that point, what is the law with respect to this situation? Suppose you file a negligently file a return with more than a 25%, so you get 6 years. Then 6 months later, you file a correct amended return. What is the statute of limitations?
The statute of limitations on that is 6 years.
Still 6 years.
The court's ruling is that since it's a running statute, that no act, be it that either
those
you
those holdings are somewhat inconsistent with your position. Right?
I think not, because the statute is already running. Our position is that there is no statute running. We're saying that, as in Bennett, where the filing of what the government characterizes as a delinquent return now starts the statute, so in my case, the filing of the amended return starts the statute. In the 25% case, that statute begins to run the day the return is filed, whether the government discovers it or doesn't discover it, no matter what happens, and neither the taxpayer nor the government can stay off the running of that statute. In our case, the government's position is that they have forever, and literally forever, because if you buy the government's position, the taxpayer can have died, his estate could have been passed on to three generations, and still the statute of limitations on transferees don't begin to run until 1 year after the initial statute would begin to run. The government can go on down three generations to assess this tax, if they so choose. The other problem that I have, that we suggest exists, is that by not having a statute of limitations of any kind, the government is in a situation where they can come in after the amended tax return has been filed and make numerous denials of deductions claimed by the taxpayer. And then that burden shifts to the taxpayer, which is exactly what happened in this situation. The taxpayer has the burden of proof of establishing the propriety of certain deductions that he has made. Having now been 10 years down the road, we run into the very reason that this court says that statutes of limitations exist, so that no issue shall be tried at a time when evidence disappears, memories fade, and witnesses are not available. To give the government an open-ended position after the amended return comes in, we suggest, opens up a substantial area of government abuse. And we suggest that when the government says,
of course, if that is the rule, Mr. Fredericks, I suppose the taxpayer has it within his control to avoid that abuse by simply not filing an amended return after he's filed a fraudulent return.
Well, that would be that by not filing the amended and taking the risk of nondisclosure. He could just sit back and hope the government never catches him.
Yes, he presumably took that risk in the first instance when he filed a fraudulent return.
Well, that comes another way around. Since our policy for taxation is really based, as this court has said many times, upon the voluntary assessment of the taxpayer of his tax, and in this case a reassessment, we suggest that, I think your question highlights very nicely, that to take the government's position puts a premium on silence. It says to the taxpayer, don't file the amended return because you have no benefit. If anything, you're going to make an admission against your own interest, subject yourself to the 50% fraud penalties and possibly criminal prosecution. Sit back and run the risk of not being disclosed. And therefore, you have no problems.
Well,
Well, that's true of almost anybody who commits fraud, and in all the variety of ways that fraud is prohibited, isn't it? That once they commit the fraud, they've committed an act which submits them to rather extensive liability, and there's very little way to recover from that.
Only if the government discovers you, and we suggest that they're one of the ways to recover it, and not to avoid. We're not suggesting that the penalties change. We're suggesting that by filing the amended return, yes, you are subject to criminal prosecution. Yes, you are subject to the tax penalty. But no, you should not be subject to an open-ended statute of limitations. You have come forth and filed an amended return. You have given the government all of the information they need on the civil side to determine what the tax is. And there is no justification at that point for allowing the government to sit back, armed with the information necessary to determine the tax, to allow them to sit back on infinitum. Here is a situation where the taxpayer has come forward and filed his amended return. He has given them the information requested, and there is no justification for the open-ended statute of limitations suggested by the government. Now, they still have their criminal remedy. We're not suggesting for one moment that the filing of the amended tax return deprives the government of its right to prosecute the individual criminally or to impose its civil 50% penalty. What we are suggesting is that the filing of the amended return, as in the case of Bennett, the filing of what the government called the delinquent return, should prevent the government from sitting on their hands forever and a day until they decide they want to take action, particularly when that delay results in substantial prejudice to this taxpayer who has now gone through a self-assessment and has filed this return. There is no government policy that warrants such an open-ended civil statute of limitations. The government disagrees. It says, well, it needs this in order to allow them to proceed with their criminal investigations. We suggest that that is really not the case. Certainly, the criminal investigation, at the time that the government has referred the matter to the Department of Justice for criminal investigations, they will have gathered enough information to meet their civil burden, which is far less than their criminal burden. Secondly, the amended return gives the government one advantage. It has an admission against interest by the would-be defendant to which they can compare with the original return and clearly determine, right from the face of the amended return, where the fraud was and what directions they have to go to. At the time that the government seeks an indictment, it certainly has a more than prima facie case. The government believes at the time that it returns an indictment against the citizen that it can prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The burden on the civil side is substantially less than that.
Has there been any indictment as against either of these taxpayers?
The Vadarato was, in fact, indicted and pled guilty. DeLeet was not. DeLeet is not a criminal case, and there has been no criminal prosecution against DeLeet. DeLeet was a situation where the taxpayer, which is a corporation, had a change in the upper echelons of management, and they came forth and filed their amended returns. There has never been a criminal prosecution in that regard. But the point that we're making is that there is no need for the government to sit back and wait on these type of situations, particularly when armed with the amended return. They've used the return in criminal prosecutions against the taxpayer, and to allow them on the civil side to wait when it is clearly going to prejudice the taxpayer, we suggest is illogical and unconscionable. I mean, Bennett was a classic case of a criminal who was indicted, who had committed tax fraud, and the court said, well, once you file the return and have given the government the very information it needs to apply the tax, there is no reason to keep the statute of limitations open. Might I also add that the Bennett case also dealt with the very problem that was raised about the 25% taxpayer. And the government acquiesced in that situation. And there was no question that in the Bennett decision, they dealt with this problem and concluded that the 25% situation didn't affect their ability to deal with the problem of the fraudulent non-filing. And also the Bennett case, again, which acquiesced in by the government in 1958, concluded that Congress intended to have these two sections dealt with identically. In fact, it used it as part of its reasoning to reach the conclusion it did that that these two sections were determined by Congress to be equally treated. Now, the Bennett case is almost identical to the case at bar with one minor exception, and that is in Bennett, the taxpayer filed nothing, and in this case, the taxpayer filed a return. And then, in both instances, one filed a delinquent return and one filed an amended return. And we suggest that there is no logic or legal reason to make a distinction and say that a fraudulent non-filer who files is entitled to the benefit of a statute of limitations. Acquiesced in by the government, 1979, it sent out a revenue ruling which expressly took that position. It said clearly that a fraudulent non-filer was entitled to the benefit of the statute of limitations upon filing the return. We suggest that there is no distinction between that case that is supported in either logic or law to say that a fraudulent filer who files an amended return shouldn't be treated in the same light and under the same circumstances. And there is nothing in the policy considerations rendered by the government, there's nothing in the statute to indicate to the contrary. I mean, I suggest that to have a distinction drawn on the filing of a piece of paper moves away from the question of intent, which is what these sections were to get to. The question of intent was the underlying basis here in both Bennett and the sections, fraudulent intent. Once that is dissipated and the taxpayer comes in and either files what is known as the delinquent return or the amended return.
Why do you say fraudulent intent is dissipated by the filing of an amended return? Certainly, if the return was fraudulent at the time it was filed, it's nonetheless fraudulent by virtue of an amended return being filed later, is it?
Yes, but there's no question about that. But at the point that the taxpayer files his amended return, he has obviously abandoned his initial intent. I don't think there's any question about that.
Well, you don't have to have a permanent intention to commit fraud.
No.
All you need is at the time you commit it.
No, his intent to escape punishment.
Yeah, I acknowledge that, but at the time he's filed the amended return, he's come forth and met his obligation as a taxpayer to give the government all of the information. He has abandoned his sins of yesterday.
It doesn't remove the fact that he committed fraud.
But it doesn't remove the penalties either, Your Honor. The criminal sanctions are still there. The 50% fraud penalty is still there. All we're saying is that it should end the government's open-ended statute of limitations so that the government...
And prevent them from doing what?
And sitting back and waiting for...
Before they do what?
Assess the tax. All we're
asking... What did they try to do in this case?
They waited 6.5 years to come in and assess the taxes.
And what did they try to assess?
They denied certain of the business deductions in question as to delete, and they attempted to impose the tax fraud penalty in Bataraco. They attempted
Did you say that you could forever impose the 50% fraud penalty?
No, I didn't. I said
you,
that the...
You, I thought you did.
No, I said the filing of the amended return does not relieve the taxpayer of his exposure to that fraud penalty.
But only for 3 years.
That's correct. Well, that is the same exact ruling in Bennett. And that's the ruling that the government has acquiesced in and has put forth in their own regulation.
The amended return is filed, and the very next day the government goes back and assesses the more than 3 years after the original failure to file or filing the fraud. They go back the next day after the amended return and impose the fraud penalties. Now, you say that's all right.
They have 3 years. I say they have 3 years from the filing of the amended return.
I know you do. Why do you say that?
Because it's the amended return that has given them the knowledge and information that they need to assess the tax. The fraud penalty, as set up by Congress, is not a penalty as such. It's a right to impose additional tax. The way the statute is worded, it's not that there is a penalty. It is in computating the additional tax due, the government has a right to add 50.
It's still a fraud penalty, isn't it, for
yes.
committing fraud?
Right. And it must be imposed with the tax itself.
Well, but you say you can do that for 3 years after filing the amended return.
That's the position that we take, Your Honor. And that was the exact position that was taken by the court in Bennett. Exactly the question at hand in Bennett was that where
we're... Let me ask you a question about the language instead. Are you arguing, just so I get your argument clear, that within the meaning of Section 6501A, that the amended return is, quote, a return?
That was the position that the Tenth Circuit took in Dowell. I'm just
wondering if you're taking that position.
Well, I don't want to abandon it since the Dowell decision was favorable to me. I think that there is much a good point can be made that the amended return is a return.
Well, if it is, then don't you just win from the plain language of 6501A?
Well, I think we do, except...
But you don't make that argument. That's why I'm kind of puzzled.
Well, the reason I don't make the argument is the problem that one comes into gray, and again, I'm not abandoning the argument. I don't think it's not the best argument that we could have made. I think Bennett is more dispositive, since that is the case that the government has agreed to and has passed the revenue ruling, and we're identical. But the problem with the argument is that the government will argue that the return is the original return, which was fraudulently filed.
Well, I understand what they can argue, but you argue, going back to these early statutes, that a fraudulent return was not a return.
That's correct.
Just as no return at all was.
That's correct.
But then why don't you say, well, as soon as they file an amended return, they have now filed a statutory return, and the statute begins to run? Why isn't that your argument?
It is my argument based upon Bennett. I accept that as my argument based upon Bennett because Bennett has decided the prior situation of the failure to file. And if you acknowledge that the fraudulent return is not a return, then you failed to file. And once you file the amended return, you're right within the square corners of Bennett. And to that extent...
But you don't argue you're within the square corners of what Congress has said the correct rule should be.
Well, I
would think we'd be more interested in the language of the statute than in sort of a convoluted reasoning from a bunch of cases.
Well, I think that, Your Honor...
But you don't make the argument in any event.
No, I adopt the argument of the Tenth Circuit, and that was the argument that they made in their opinion, that the initial return was not a Zellenbach return. It wasn't an honest evidence to file a return, and it was the amended return that was, in fact, the first return filed. I suggest that that is in keeping with the position we've taken in Bennett, and which the government has acquiesced, and the logic of Bennett carries right through to that direction. But I certainly suggest that a return, an amended return, can be viewed as a return under the statute, and then within the arguments of 6501A, as taking us out of the exceptions that follow. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Lauber.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case presents a straightforward question of statutory construction. Section 6501A provides, in general, that the Commissioner must assess the tax within 3 years of the date a return is filed. Section 6501C1 has an exception to this rule. It says that in the case of a false or fraudulent return filed with the intent to evade tax, the tax may be assessed at any time. The Code has allowed the Commissioner to assess the tax at any time in fraud cases since 1918. We think the words of the statute are clear and unambiguous. Section 6501C1, the at any time provision, plainly came into operation when the taxpayers filed their original returns here because those returns were or are deemed for present purposes to have been false and fraudulent. And there is nothing in that section which could serve to call off its operation by reference to a fraudulent filer's later conduct, be it the filing of an amended return or doing anything else. Likewise, subsection A with the 3-year rule plainly did not come into play when taxpayers filed their original returns here, because that section by its terms cannot apply when the return is false and fraudulent. And there is nothing in subsection A which could cause its general 3-year rule to come into effect later on, depending on the filing of an amended return. When one recalls that...
Let me stop you right there. Why are you so sure of that? Couldn't one say that the amended return is a return within the meaning of the statute?
Well, we would agree, Justice Stevens, it is a return, but the phrase used in A is the return. And the Court early on
noted...
But
that is the only statutory return, isn't it? Couldn't you say that?
You're presupposing the argument that Dowell made that the fraudulent return is not a return. We think that must fall because C1 uses the phrase fraudulent return. So it must be a return within the meaning of the section we're construing.
Let me just ask one question, and I won't interrupt any. In your view, is an amended return a return within the meaning of the code?
Our view is that an amended return, if accepted by the commissioner, is a return for the tax year, but it is not the return referred to in A.
Right.
That's because Congress, by using the definite article, we think, indicated that it meant the original return for the year, not an amended return.
So your argument would fall if instead of the word the in 6501A, Congress had selected the word A.
No, because then we'd still be covered by C1.
Well, but it wouldn't be quite as clear.
Wouldn't be quite as clear. It would give us only one string rather than two to our bow, which I think we have now. But one recalls that, as this Court has held, a limitations period must be construed strictly in favor of the government. We think the plain language of the Code here, if given a natural reading, indicates that once a false return has been filed, the Commissioner has an unlimited period to assess the tax, whatever the taxpayer later does. And we think this natural reading of the statute is confirmed if one looks to the structure and operation of other code provisions. To begin with, it is clear that a taxpayer who has filed a false return remains liable for criminal and civil fraud penalties on that account, regardless of later repentant conduct. The fraud is complete when the fraudulent return is filed. In short, the case remains a case of a false or fraudulent return, despite the filing of an honest amended return, indefinitely for purposes of imposing substantive fraud liability. Now, we think it's logical to infer from that that the case should also remain a case of a fraudulent return.
It doesn't make any difference where you got your information that a fraud had been committed. You may have gotten it from an amended return.
Or from an anonymous tip or a third party or a bank or an accounting firm or anyone. We think it's just another form of information the commissioner has to process in doing his fraud investigation.
In assessing any additional taxes, in either one of these cases, is there additional taxes assessed after the filing of the amended return other than the fraud penalty?
Yes. What happened in DeLee?
So you don't... except the accuracy of the amended return?
I believe after we investigated the return of Badaracco, I think that turned out to be accurate. In DeLete...
Because you couldn't really, after 3 years, couldn't have assessed any additional taxes on the amended return, could you?
Yes, we could have.
Why?
Because the commissioner is empowered not only to assess the fraud penalty, but the tax at any time in a fraud case.
Well, I know, but there may be the... You might be able to impose the fraud penalty, but could you say you made a mistake in calculating your tax on the amended return other than the fraud penalty?
That's what happened in DeLete, Justice White.
Well,
what DeLete did
that after 3 years from the amended return?
Why? Because the amended return, we submit, has no relevance in determining the limitations period in fraud cases. The statute says at any time. What happened in the DeLete case was the amended return reported the omitted gross income of the corporation, but it also claimed a deduction in the exact same amount for salaries paid.
At least there could be a difference between assessing more taxes than shown on the amended return and assessing some penalty for the fraud that was committed prior.
There cannot, Justice White, because as counsel for petitioner, well, Congress might have done that, but they didn't, because the fraud penalty is a colloquial phrase to refer to an addition to the tax on account of fraud. It's all one ball of wax, really.
Suppose you hadn't attempted to impose any fraud penalty at all. You just said, your amended return doesn't accurately state your taxes. And so we're assessing additional taxes.
And you did it
more than 3 years after the filing of the amended return.
If there were no finding of fraud, we wouldn't have the unlimited period. Because it only applies in cases of a false or fraudulent return.
Well, then I would tell you again, suppose you do two things more than 3 years after the amended return is filed. One, you say you didn't state your taxes correctly, wholly aside from there being any fraud.
Make another amended return.
No, you did. We just say you do two things. You say fail to state your basic tax accurately in your amended return. Also, we're assessing a fraud penalty. Now, you say you can do both of those.
We're saying that if there's fraud in the original return, we can assess additional tax itself plus what we call the fraud penalty indefinitely, no matter how many amended returns the taxpayer files.
On the basis of the original return.
Exactly. There would not be a second act of fraud if the amended return were honest, but that doesn't matter. We're going back to the antecedent fraud on the original return.
And you say that even if at the time of filing the amended return the taxpayer voluntarily pays the fraud penalty, you'd still say you can go on forever.
If the taxpayer voluntarily pays, if his return is accurate and he voluntarily pays
he first filed a fraudulent return.
Right.
Then 6 months later, he files an accurate amended return and voluntarily tenders the fraud penalty.
Okay. If that return is completely accurate and he correctly computes the fraud penalty, there's nothing left for the government to do. We've gotten all we can on the civil
law.
He thinks it's accurate, but you 10 years later decide he over-deducted something like his automobile expense.
Well, then he would have incorrectly computed his fraud penalty, because if we audit the return further and determine that he got the deficiency wrong, although he tried to be honest, he got it wrong.
So
he'd have the fraud
penalty
wrong, too.
He only gave $500,000 where he should have given an extra $500, say. What I'm saying is that he substantially paid it. You could go on forever. Yeah.
Is there anything to prevent a taxpayer from filing his initial return and then an amended return and then a second amended return?
No, a taxpayer can amend.
It's a matter of grace whether it'll be accepted.
Accepted, that's right.
Now, suppose he has filed a fraudulent return initially, as you claim here, a less fraudulent or correct return the second time, and still a fraudulent one later, the third one. What's the starting date then?
Well, the starting date is the first return. The finishing date is perpetuity. Our position is whenever the first return is fraudulent, we have forever to come against the taxpayer. That's the language the statute requires. And I think this language is also supported by the fact that amended returns are not even recognized by the code. The code does not explicitly permit the taxpayer to file amended returns, nor does it require the commissioner to accept them if they are filed. Indeed, this court last term in Hillsborough Bank noted that amended returns are entirely creatures of IRS origin, and the commissioner has discretion to reject them. Now, because amended returns are not part of the structure that Congress enacted in the code, and because the commissioner can reject them in his discretion, we think Congress is very unlikely to have intended that these documents would have any kind of controlling effect on the operation of the limitations rules.
May I ask one other question? I said I wouldn't, but say you file an original return that's valid. You think it's valid, but you forgot something. So you file a year later, you file an amended return correcting a mistake.
Okay, a first return is non-fraudulent but inaccurate.
Not fraud, but just inaccurate. What period of time does the government have in which to, when does the 3 years
3 years from the original return.
So that if the government accepts an amended return 2.5 years after the original one, why?
No, this court held in the companion case to Zellerbach paper that an amended return, if both the original and amended are honest, yeah, does not give the commissioner more time. He has 3 years from the original return's filing date. Now, because we think the language of the code is clear and unambiguous, and because we think that the plain reading of the statute is confirmed by the operation of other code provisions, there's no need here to go on to look at tax policy as a basis for decision.
Mr. Lauber, may I ask you whether fraud is easier to detect or to prove in the Bennett situation than in the situation involved in these cases?
Well, in fact, the Bennett is where there is a fraudulent failure to file any return at all. I guess I have to say that it's not easier to detect fraud there. What happens in practice is the commissioner brings very, very few actions, prosecutions on the criminal front for fraudulent non-filing. The reason for that is that it's very hard to get a jury to buy the fact that a guy committed fraud if he did nothing at all. So, in fact, there are only a handful of those prosecutions. What the government does is alternatively bring a prosecution for willful failure to file, where fraud need not be proven. And that is it's only a misdemeanor rather than a felony. So in practice, the way we deal with that problem is to go the other route.
Well, what element does fraudulent failure to file have in it that willful failure to file doesn't?
Well, it's hard to make up a jury instruction on that. Willful, I guess, is an intentional violation of a known legal duty, and fraud connotes something about bad acts beyond that.
Well, but it is harder to convince the jury. Well, intention to deceive, doesn't it?
Yes. But in fact, the commissioner generally does not indict for fraudulent failure to file. Now, the petitioners, of course, base their entire case on tax policy. Their view is that once the commissioner has an amended return that ultimately turns out to be non-fraudulent, he doesn't need the additional time provided by Section C1. At that point, petitioners contend the commissioner's fraud investigation should be limited by the 3-year rule that applies in non-fraud cases. We think this argument is wrong and that the Court of Appeals was correct in determining that, in fact, strong reasons of tax policy support a plain reading of the statute. First of all, the filing of an amended return, however honest it ultimately proves to be, does not really change the nature of a tax fraud investigation. Congress chose to permit assessment at any time in fraud cases for very good reasons. Fraud is hard to investigate, both because the controlling issue is one of intent and because fraud is often accompanied by its badges, such as the falsification or destruction of records. Beyond that, the commissioner has a burden of proof on the fraud issue. But the reasons that led Congress to enact the at-any-time rule in fraud cases persist, even though the taxpayer files an amended return. The case is still a fraud case with all the attendant problems of examination, and the commissioner still has the burden of proof. An amended return comes with no imprimatur upon it. Indeed, it comes from a taxpayer who has already made false statements under penalties of perjury. In our view, the data on the amended return are no different from any other data that come into the commissioner's hands during a tax fraud investigation. It must be examined just as carefully. Now, that point might be illustrated by the facts of the cases before us today. In these cases, a fraud consisted of diverting business receivables into the secret bank accounts maintained on behalf of the company's employees. Now, the commissioner could have been alerted to that fraud, both the fact of the fraud and the amount of the diverted receipts, in any number of ways. It could have been a tip from an unhappy employee, as indeed almost happened in Delete. It could have been a tip from a competitor or supplier or customer of the business, or it could have come from a bank or accounting firm. We think it's clear that it could not possibly be contended that had the commissioner got this useful, correct information from a third party, the three-year rule would then all of a sudden apply in the fraud case. And we think there's no reason on grounds of tax policy for a different result, merely because that data happens to be contained in the vehicle of an amended return. In short, our view is that the commissioner's need for the unlimited period of assessment in fraud cases is not materially diminished by the filing of an amended return. And we think there is no reason to hold that amended returns of all the manifold documents and data that might bear on tax fraud have the unique effect, the singular effect, of shortening to 3 years the unlimited period that governs fraud cases generally. But we think there is a second and discreet reason for holding on grounds of tax policy that the three-year rule should not come into play in tax fraud cases. And this has to do with the commissioner's duty to pursue criminal tax enforcement. As this Court has noted in the past, Congress has charged the commissioner with pursuing both criminal and civil aspects in tax fraud. The limitations period for prosecuting criminal tax fraud is not 3, but 6 years. As a result, it will often be impossible on practical grounds and unwise as a matter of efficient and sound tax administration for the commissioner to close down his civil audit within 3 years of getting an amended return from the taxpayer. The practical problems here, we think, are fairly evident. Once the commissioner makes a referral to the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution, he loses his primary audit tool, that is, its power to summons the books, records, and testimony of the taxpayers and of third parties. This result is required by LaSalle Bank from this Court and by Congress's later amendment of Code Section 7602. But that means, having lost the summons power, the commissioner must, in effect, close down or suspend his civil audit because he has no way of getting information from the taxpayer. But apart from these practical problems, the commissioner has long had a policy of suspending civil audit pending the completion of criminal proceedings. This policy is set forth in the Internal Revenue Manual, and it stems from the difficulty of conducting at the same time a civil tax fraud litigation while a criminal tax fraud investigation is continuing. And the most obvious problem, of course, is the risk of killing the criminal case by making a premature disclosure of evidence to the potential defendant. If the three-year rule is held to apply here, the commissioner, right in the middle of his criminal tax fraud investigation, is going to have to send a notice of deficiency to the taxpayer asserting civil tax fraud. The taxpayer will then go into tax court or the district court, and the commissioner will be required by the rules of those courts to allege fraud affirmatively in his answer and then be subject to discovery, interrogatories, and depositions about his fraud theory. I think it's pretty clear that if the commissioner is required to open up his files right in the middle of an ongoing criminal investigation, laying out his theory of fraud and the facts he expects to rely on in proving fraud, that criminal case could probably be killed. Beyond that, we think there are other problems in maintaining an ongoing criminal investigation and a parallel civil tax fraud litigation. In the civil case, a taxpayer, for example, will probably assert the Fifth Amendment privilege, barring any introduction of evidence on the issue of fraud. There could be problems with witnesses because of their premature disclosure of their names to a potential defendant. And finally, there can be problems where the taxpayer puts up a defense as a beleaguered defendant in a criminal action, which asserting that the commissioner is trying to dun him on 5 different fronts at once, grab his money, and juries occasionally have been persuaded by that kind of evidence. So for all these reasons, we think that the commissioner's policy of suspending civil tax audit until the completion of criminal proceedings salutary, both on grounds of fairness to the taxpayer and on grounds of sensible administration of the tax laws. Petitioner's argument here would effectively kill that policy. And finally, we think there's one last reason of tax policy that counsels in favor of a plain reading of the code here. And this has to do with the commissioner's overall duties to enforce the tax laws. The tax laws are complicated, taxpayers are well advised and sometimes devious, and the commissioner has limited resources. Every year, about 2 million amended returns are filed. But we think it would be a very bad idea to let amended returns become yet another tool in the hands of people trying to evade the tax laws, which they can use to manipulate the limitations period to their own advantage, depending on how, what, and when they file. If there are no further questions, we think the decision of the court below should be affirmed.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Fredericks?
Yes, I do, very briefly.
You have 4 minutes remaining.
I'd like to just respond to one question that Justice White asked about the imposition of the fraud penalty. And I read from the government's revenue ruling that I referred to earlier, and I think the government's position is very simple. The imposition of a civil fraud penalty under Section 6635B of the Code that does not necessarily indicate that the tax can be assessed at any time under Section 6501C, even though the taxpayer was subject to the penalty for underpayment due to fraud. And it goes on to hold that that must be done within 3 years of, and that was the Bennett case they were referring to, but within 3 years of the filing of the delinquent return. Judge Stevens, your question concerning the original return, which was subsequently modified by an amended return, that case, I believe, was decided in the Tenth Circuit, Alke versus Nichols, and in that case, the court held that it was the amended return, since the original return was insufficient, that the amended return was the return that started the running of the statute of limitations. We've cited that case in both Badaracco Brink and ours, but it was not as the government had indicated on that.
The government disagrees with you on that, though.
Well, I'm just citing the case and giving Your Honor the authority for it. On the question of minimal tax fraud questions, there's no such thing as a minimal return. If a return is fraudulent in any degree, it is deemed by the government to be totally fraudulent, irrespective of the amount, irrespective of the issue, and therefore would be subject to this open-ended statute of limitations urged by the government. I suggest that the government's tax policies are not well taken, and we've covered each of them in our briefs. But the point at hand is the government has several ways of avoiding this problem. One, as the Chief Justice raised when I initially stepped to the podium, and that is, don't accept the amended return. Two, the government can say, taxpayer, your time is about to run out, extend the statute of limitations. They do it all the time, at a regular basis. Three, simply take your figures and assess the tax. This is not an attempt to in any way inhibit the government's criminal investigation. It is not in any way inhibited to avoid penalties. It is designed to say that a taxpayer who has seen the error of his ways and has filed an amended return shouldn't be open to a statute of limitations that runs forever, and the government shouldn't be allowed to sit back and wait 10, 15, 20, 30 years and then come in and deny certain deductions that the taxpayer has made, which places the burden on the taxpayer to prove the validity of those deductions. We suggest that the position in Bennett, acquiesced in by the government, is identical here, that the policy's considerations are in fact in favor of the taxpayer, that nothing we are requesting strains or prevents the government from enforcing the tax laws. And for those reasons, we respectfully suggest that the decision of the Third Circuit be reversed and the decision of the lower courts be reinstated. Thank you all.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.